Empire State survey of manufacturers and a key measure of consumer sentiment. For NPR News, I'm Steve Beckner.
California firefighters report progress in battling a wildfire in the Santa Barbara area. Officials say the blaze is now about 65% contained. It burned 13 square miles, destroyed 77 houses, and forced tens of thousands of people to flee their homes over the weekend. Most of them have now been allowed to return home. Investigators say they think they know what caused the fire, which began last Tuesday, a power tool being used to clear brush to prevent the spread of fire. They say some residents had received notices that they had until June 1st to clear potentially hazardous brush from around their homes. Authorities declined to say what kind of tool was used or if charges would be filed if the responsible party is found. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from PBS, presenting We Shall Remain. The series concludes tonight with Wounded Knee. Details at pbs.org/weshallremain.
WILO programs are made possible in part by Bevere Cafe 2, offering gourmet sandwiches, salads, and specialty coffees with seating inside or outside in the lower courtyard of the Institute for Genomic Biology next to Morrow Plotz on the U of I campus.
Vintage vinyl is coming soon. Bring your used records, CDs, DVDs, and working stereo equipment to our location in the east wing of Lincoln Square, Urbana, between 9 a.m. and 4 p.m. by Wednesday, May 13th. And mark your calendar for the sale date, May 16th. For more information, call Dean Geiken at 217-333-6503.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. There was a time in America when it seemed that here in this country we had an endless supply of oil, and it was controlled not by big corporations, but by families. This morning in this hour of Focus, we'll explore the lives of four individuals who made their fortunes in oil and in the process became very wealthy and politically influential: Roy Cullen, H.L. Hunt, Glenn Murchison, and Sid Richardson, four men who came from modest backgrounds to form one of the great powerhouses of the 20th century, Texas Oil. Our guest for the program is Brian Burrow. He says these men became a class unto themselves, shifting wealth and power away from the East Coast and establishing Texas as a place of both economic and political influence. He writes about this in his new book. The title is The Big Rich: The Rise and Fall of the Greatest Texas Oil Fortunes. The book is out now, published by Penguin Press. If you'd like to read it, our guest Brian Burrow is a special correspondent at Vanity Fair. He is also the author of a number of bestsellers. Probably the one best known is the book Barbarians at the Gate. Another of his books, Public Enemies, America's Greatest Crime Wave and the Birth of the FBI, 1933 to 1934. That book is just out now in paperback. It's published by Penguin and is the basis for a movie that will be coming out this summer. A movie that stars Johnny Depp and Christian Bale, so you might want to take a look at that and keep an eye out for that film. And also this morning, of course, as we talk, questions are welcome. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people just try to keep their questions, comments brief so we can keep moving along. But, of course, anyone's welcome to join in the conversation here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point, questions, comments are welcome. Mr. Burrow, hello.
David, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Couldn't be better.
Good.
Gorgeous day here in beautiful suburban New Jersey.
Well, it's pretty nice here, too. So we'll say that's a pretty good way to start the week.
Yep.
You know, one of the things I know that you have said about this book is that you felt that you were lucky that you had gotten to a point in your writing career where you could pick your projects and you could pick things that really personally excited you to write about. And I think that you said that about Public Enemies, and I know that you've said that about The Big Rich. So tell me, what is it about these four men that you write about in this book that you found so fascinating and engaging that you wanted to spend a lot of time with them and with this project?
Yeah, these the Big Rich of Texas, you know, the wealthiest oilmen as a class were kind of dying out by the time I reached adulthood in the early and mid 80s when I was a cub reporter for the Wall Street Journal down in Texas. But I grew up on stories of, you know, H.L. Hunt, the richest man in the country, the three-time bigamist. And as I grew, you know, I'm now what, 47, I guess. As I look back on the on those stories, they were such great stories. It was such a great period of emergence for Texas, and yet I found that if you brought up the names of one of these gentlemen in a conversation today, it just doesn't ring bells for people. And I wanted to resuscitate these stories as well as tell the broader tale of an era of Texas economic and political emergence before it was too late to do it. Before, there were really no one. There would be no one left to tell the tale. So that was kind of the impetus behind wanting to write The Big Rich.
Yeah, and I think that you make the point that if one thinks about the character of the Texas oil man that we have come to know from popular media, and you can think about J.R. Ewing, or if you go back to the film Giant, one of the few that James Dean starred in, where he played this character Jet Rink, that these really larger than life characters, these people who came up from obscurity, became hugely wealthy and powerful. The kinds of characters that we've come to know through popular media, these people really existed. And that these guys that you wrote about, they were the real deal.
Well, you're exactly right. I mean, today we've lived with this image of the big brawling, big talking Texas oilman for so long. I think we think that it dates back to the beginning of the Republic, but it doesn't. It dates to 1948, where really that was the beginning, with a single story in Life magazine that introduced the nation to these four men who had, until then, were little known even outside their home cities, and asked for the first time, were these the richest men in America? And this was at a time where the richest men in America, of course, were all named Rockefeller or DuPont. And this was kind of a seismic shift away from our understanding of American wealth. Suddenly you had to factor in these nutty new Texas millionaires, and they quickly spawned this new kind of regional archetype of the Texas oilman that was, as you say, was swiftly enshrined in Giant the book, first a number one bestseller, Giant the movie, and then on down the years through J.R. Ewing. All those characters and that whole idea really began with these four gentlemen who I call by what they were called back then, the Big Four.
Yeah. Well, it's really striking how quickly these people became wealthy and how wealthy they became, going from a point where they essentially had nothing to the point within about 30 years where they were billionaires. What sort of wealth really are we talking about here?
Yeah, it's a good question. People forget that while the first great oil well in America was in fact found at Spindletop, east of Houston, in 1901. It took 20, 30 years before any Texans really got control of that oil, and it happened in a way that is quite frankly little understood even in Texas itself, David. Up until the Great Depression, most of American oil and most of oil in Texas was controlled by the big oil companies. And what happened, to make a very long story short, is that during the Depression, all the major oil companies kind of scaled in their exploration budgets. They just didn't have money to look for oil anymore, and they were more than happy to let individual oil men in Texas and elsewhere go in and try to find some oil. And if they found it, maybe the majors would buy it. Well, what happened is during a scant five-year period from about 1930 to 1935, Texas oilmen, individuals, including my Big Four, rushed in and found not only the largest oil field ever found in the continental U.S., the East Texas field, but several other mammoth fields, several of the top 10 or 12 largest ever found. And that, more than anything else, led to this explosion of individual wealth that created the character of the Texas oilman. H.L. Hunt, by 1948, was probably worth somewhere in the nature of $600 million, which doesn't sound like a lot now, but back then it made him probably the richest man in the country and maybe even in the world. But what was interesting is when these gentlemen got so rich so fast during the 1930s, no one knew it. Hmm. Absolutely no one, inside or outside Texas. The nature of publicity being what it was then, plus, you know, there were wars and depressions to sort through. It really wasn't until 1948 that this Life magazine article I referenced kind of introduced these men to the country. And you know, suddenly the rest of the country has to start dealing with Texas.
Yeah. Well, it's also interesting the way that the oil business changed when Texas and its oil came online, because before this, there was oil in the United States. There was an oil business, and Standard Oil dates from the late 19th century. But the kind of oil that we think about in the amounts that we think about it now, people think about a gusher. Think about the idea of drilling a hole in the ground and having oil just come shooting out the way that it does in the movies, that until Texas came on, that kind of thing just didn't happen.
No, the first gusher ever in history that we know of was at Spindletop in 1901. And there was a series of them. I mean, actual, you know, oil shooting up into the sky, that type of thing. I mean, not to overstate it, but it practically became commonplace in Texas as these wells came online. And you're right, while there had been an oil business, it was mostly used to refine kerosene for heating lamps and the like. But the amount of oil found in Texas, and just at Spindletop, changed the world. It changed and created the modern oil industry. That first well at Spindletop, as I recall, produced at a greater rate than every other oil well in America at the time. The first half dozen oil wells at Spindletop in Texas went at a greater production than all the oil fields in the world at the time. So much oil that for the first time steamships around the world were able to switch over from coal to oil, as well as all the trains in the world went over to oil. And then, of course, shortly after, it made possible the great boom in automobiles.
Yeah, so that really, it not only was this important for the economy of Texas, for the economy of the United States, it was really important for the economy of the world and was responsible for a big shift in what was the energy source on which the world ran.
Yeah, it introduced the age that we live in today. I mean, this before Spindletop, before Texas oil, the oil business was a pretty small thing. I mean, it was basically for kerosene and some other byproducts. It wasn't until Texas oil came online in the early 1900s that ships, trains, and ultimately automobiles all began running on oil and oil products. And, of course, Texas has never been the same as a result.
Yeah. Our guest, Brian Burrow, he's a special correspondent at Vanity Fair. He's the author of a number of books. His most recent is The Big Rich, The Rise and Fall of the Greatest Texas Oil Fortunes. The book is published by Penguin Press. It is just out now. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. We have our first caller here in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
What was the name of the real life name of the character upon which the book Giant, Jet Rink character is based? That was the first question. And if you know, what was the name of the fabulous hotel that he built somewhere in Texas? I don't know where, but it was torn down in the 80s. I know that, but apparently it was quite a palace. But you happen to know what that is?
Boy, you lobbed a fastball right in my wheelhouse. The gentleman that Jet Rink was based upon was named Glenn McCarthy, and he is probably the fifth of the Big Four oilmen. In fact, I write a couple of chapters about McCarthy because his story is so amazing. Americans of a certain age, and certainly Texans of a certain age, will remember McCarthy mostly because he built what was at the time, in 1949, the largest building between Chicago and L.A., maybe even between New York and L.A., the Shamrock Hotel.
That's it.
And, McCarthy built this hotel. It came out barely a year after that Life magazine article at a time that America was just beginning to identify and come to grips with what Texas oil money meant. And the Shamrock Hotel, and to a lesser extent Mr. McCarthy, became kind of the great symbol of the new Texas, the new post-war Texas. And, of course, what makes the story so great is McCarthy himself, who is the very model of the hard-drinking, hard-fighting, hard-living Texas oilman. And his story is just great because, of course, he massively overreached to build this gigantic hotel, which was, of course, famous for the great party that everybody in Texas, it seemed like, came to. Of course, it was a symphony of chaos. And McCarthy expanded so quickly and built so much that he lost it all, lost control of all of it in, what, barely 3 or 4 years. And while, yes, the hotel did live on, it became known no longer as the Shamrock Hotel, but the Shamrock Hilton, because it was built by the Hilton people. And you may remember it. I certainly took a weekend or two there as a teenager, went to a wedding there in the early 80s, and it was torn down at really the end of an era. And it's, matter of fact, one of the last scenes in this book is the tearing down of the Shamrock, the great symbol of Texas, in about, I think it was 1986.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Okay, thank you.
All right, other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. There's a lot in this book, and there's a lot of information and detail on the particularly the four guys that are the at the center of the story. Having said that, though, can you just tell us a little bit about each of these people? Maybe start with Roy Cullen.
Well, the greatest four oilmen of Texas, two of them were in Dallas, one in Fort Worth, and then in Houston, Roy Cullen, a man who is little remembered, really, even in Texas, in large part because he was a champion of what we call ultra-conservative causes, meaning he was a far right winger. Not big on people of color, Jews, or civil rights. He died in 1957, and he was for years the wealthiest man in Texas until H.L. Hunt probably eclipsed him. He was known for kind of sparring with a series of presidential candidates and presidents, from Wendell Willkie through Truman and Eisenhower, and kind of became a pest to any number of them. And, of course, there's also the great story of the fight over his wealth after his death. He, without going into too much detail, he spawned one of his grandsons, ended up growing up in Italy and was, kind of an Italian playboy who returned from Italy in the 1960s and launched this decades-long fight between the Italian branch of the family and the Texas branch of the family. It was like something straight out of the television show Dallas.
Mm. I'll tell you what, I have another caller here. Rather than make them late, we'll get to them, and we can also, of course, I'm sure, talk about some of these other people that you profile in the book. Let's take the caller, though, in Bloomington, Indiana, I believe, here, line number four. Hello.
Hi. I have two questions. First, about oil geology. You know, today, big companies prospect for oil with sophisticated geology, like underground sound waves. And I think they even have underground radar. What kind of geology did the early oil prospectors have?
Very little. Most of what we know about most of the devices that we use to look for oil didn't start into wide use until the 20s and 30s, and, you know, primarily sonar. But in the early days, people did it purely by nose. And Mr. Cullen, for instance, was called a creekologist, C-R-E-E-K, because he looked for oil in low spots around creeks or wherever there was a depression in the land, thinking that might say something about oil underneath. In fact, in those early days, people didn't have any understanding of where oil came from. People thought it was in underground lakes or maybe underground rivers. Now, of course, later, these individuals in Texas did begin to use some of the more sophisticated type things that oil companies used.
Yeah. Second question, when the when these early prospectors got a gusher, how did they get that gusher under control?
Sometimes it wasn't too easy. But usually what would happen is when you had a gusher that would come up, you know, there are just all sorts of stories about the craziness in trying to wrestle it under control. But if nothing else, you had to take a big old concrete collar, something that would take, you know, the size of a giant, let's say, 6 foot round manhole, and it would take 4, 5, 6 guys to wrestle it on top of the hole just to stop it from coming out. But there are all sorts of stories of derring do by Mr. Cullen and others of, you know, trying to wrestle these great oil wells under control, all while knowing that, you know, any spark, a cigarette or anything, would cause a catastrophic explosion.
But thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Other questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let's talk about H.L. Hunt, someone who is, I suppose in a way these guys are all colorful, but I think that heart, that's kind of an understatement, I think, when you apply that word to Mr. Hunt.
Well, yeah, H.L. Hunt, it's funny, you know, he passed in 1974. And I think most Americans now, his name is no longer a household word. In the span of just my lifetime, I think it's gone from being a household word to not. H.L. Hunt was the living personification of every stereotype you can possibly think of where a Texas oilman was concerned. Although he actually lived fairly quietly, brown bagged his lunch to work every day. He was, the first and the greatest of the individual Texas oilmen. He was, for 20 or 30 years, probably the richest man in the country. And he did it all, really, not by finding his first oil well, but he had the good luck to stumble upon a down-on-his-luck wildcatter who actually found the East Texas field in 1930. And Hunt, when the fella promptly went out of business there was a scandal. Hunt bought the fella out for next to no money up front. Bought him out for $30,000 up front, which he borrowed, and then paid him the rest out of the back end, out of the oil payments itself. Hunt overnight, you know, at the time he was a small-time oilman. He'd actually been a professional gambler in southern Arkansas. Became kind of the one of the biggest figures in Texas, and of course, in later years, we learned about all the incredible soap operas that had gone on inside the Hunt family, in large part because there was not just one Hunt family, there were three. Mm. Initially, he had a second wife and a second secret family, bought off that woman around the time of World War II, promptly took up with another woman, and so he had a number of families. I think he ultimately ended up with about 13 kids, a series of children and half-children, some of whom, of course, went on to make their own headlines. Some listeners might remember the great effort by the Hunt family, by H.L.'s two sons, Bunker and Herbert, to corner the world market in silver in 1979 and 1980, which, of course, squandered a good deal of the Hunt fortune.
Yeah, and that I guess that invites a question about second generations, and that often you see this pattern where you have this individual who comes up from obscurity, becomes extremely wealthy, amasses this big family fortune, and then the next generation essentially squanders it. For these individuals, how did their progeny do with the family fortune?
In most cases, well, of the four families that we're looking at, Mr. Cullen actually gave away something like 93% of his wealth. Great philanthropist. Of the other three families, two pretty much squandered a lot of it. The Hunt family, of course, is now so large, hundreds of individuals. Some are doing quite well, but Bunker and Herbert, of course, did squander. You know, they took the joke in Texas was, what's the fastest way to get $500 million? Well, if you're Bunker Hunt, you start off with $5 billion, because he lost about 90% of his wealth there. And much the same happened with the Murchison family. The father, Clint Murchison, had two sons, Clint Jr. and John, who are probably best known to some listeners as the founding owners of the Dallas Cowboys. The Murchisons unfortunately expanded into real estate at a very bad time in the 1970s and lost most of their wealth. in the great oil crash of the 80s. The one family that did quite well, as a matter of fact, was the fourth Wildcatter that we're discussing, Sid Richardson of Fort Worth. He died childless, but his great nephews, the Bass brothers of Fort Worth, took what remained of his fortune, which was not terribly much by the time that they took control of it about 1970, but managed to take, through very smart Warren Buffett-like investing between 1970 and 1986, just investing in the takeovers in the stock market. His great nephew, Sid Bass, took a family fortune that was worth something on the order of $50 million and turned into $5 billion. So not all those second and third generations were filled with disappointments.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Brian Burrow. He's a special correspondent at Vanity Fair. He's the author of a number of best-selling books, including Barbarians at the Gate and Public Enemies, America's Greatest Crime Wave and the Birth of the FBI. That has been made into a major motion picture, as they say, and that's going to be out this summer. The book itself is just out recently in paperback from Penguin, so if you'd like to read that, look for that book. His brand new book, the one we're talking about here this morning, is The Big Rich, The Rise and Fall of the Greatest Texas Oil Fortunes. That's also published by Penguin and is out now in the bookstore, so you can seek it out. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the kind of qualities, I guess, that all four of these individuals shared was that they were very, very conservative politically, and that helped they and their money helped to establish American conservatism and also helped to establish Texas, the state of Texas, as a place with a lot of political influence. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, people today, we talk about liberal and conservative politics, and I think without a keen sense of history, you might think that, well, golly, that's been going on for 250 years, the fight between liberals and conservatives that our political environment seems so riven by right now. In fact, the rise of modern conservatism, came almost fully formed during the 1950s and the late 1940s. It rose because of opposition to communism and opposition to civil rights and just to a lot of changes that were going about in the world. And while I want to be careful not to overstate that the great oilmen of Texas founded conservatism, that certainly is not the case. These men, by and large, were not thinkers. They were bankrollers. They wrote checks. The wealthiest individuals in the country in those crucial early years of conservatism between, say, 1948 and 1958 were very much men like H.L. Hunt and Roy Cullen, who channeled tens of millions of dollars into the birth and growth of early conservative causes. In fact, Mr. Hunt, people might be surprised to learn, actually founded a whole conservative network, kind of the first ever Fox News, if you will, a series of newsletters, radio programs, and also nationally syndicated television programs that existed throughout much of the 50s. He ultimately shut those down, and then even more ahead of his time in the late 50s, started one of the very first conservative religious radio networks called Lifeline that ran until shortly before his death. So these men, while they were not thinkers, by and large, although Mr. Hunt certainly styled himself one, they were quite instrumental in the early growth and spread of conservative politics, especially during the early 50s. Mm. I point out during the book that in their first major misstep, and really what kills two or three of them as budding political entrepreneurs, was in fact their early backing of Joe McCarthy, and of course his anti-communist hunts. When McCarthy kind of went down in 1954, there was a real backlash against Texas and Texas oilmen that's largely been forgotten. I mean, Texas oilmen, by and large, got a lot of the blame for McCarthy and all this, move to the right. And so while Texas oil and Texas oilmen endured and became even more powerful in the years to come, There weren't, you know, with the end of McCarthy, there was kind of some scaling back, the idea that men like Mr. Hunt or Mr. Cullen might become these kind of leading political entrepreneurs kind of died there.
Yeah, but even so, for a period of decades, and I guess you could argue that that period has actually just kind of ended, or in a sense, that for a period of decades, Texas and politicians from Texas, and meaning people who were in Congress, were very powerful, and that their power base, to a large extent, was the kind of wealth that was generated by people like this.
Well, exactly. And what I meant to say, and probably just said it poorly, is that while these men as individuals kind of retreated from the headlines after the mid-50s as political entrepreneurs, the use of their money and the money of many other conservative Texas oilmen and businessmen of other types grew and grew and grew. And Texas oil money has been for years the most single most reliable backbone of the growth of not only conservatives but the Republican Party. Lyndon Johnson, we may forget, he was almost solely initially a creature of Texas oil money, of Sid Richardson and Clint Murchison's oil money. Now, they had a falling out with Mr. Johnson when, as he attained the White House, he tacked to the left and became much more a liberal Democrat. Oh, they wouldn't even take his phone calls after that. But when George H.W. Bush came along, Texas oilmen loved him. He was their type of oilman. But the most perfect, you know, presidential candidate you could ever have if you're a Texas oilman was the last George Bush, who, after all, had been a Texas oilman. And in fact, I make the argument that this great era of the power of Texas conservative money, of Texas oil money, really just died in January. With the passing of George Bush, I think you can say that is the end of about a 60-year era in American politics.
Yeah. We talked a little bit earlier about how quickly these men became wealthy, that essentially came up from nothing or from an undistinguished background at least, and that they, over a period of maybe about 20 years, became very wealthy. And by the mid-40s, these men were among the richest people in the United States. And yet at the same time, the point you make is that really they were not that well known. And it wasn't until the national media kind of discovered them in the late 40s did they and their place in the economy and the way that they lived their lives start to get attention. And we started to have stories about them, particularly about how they lived and how they spent their money. How did they feel about that kind of notoriety, and were they pleased with that or were they not?
Well, I think, of course, they'd tell you they hated it, but privately they loved it. If you were alive and reading from 1948 to 1958, it's hard to pick up any type of periodical, newspaper, magazine, that didn't have something about these new Texas oilmen. And often they were kind of this, you know, lifestyle porn. You know, they look at their mansions and their private islands. Mr. Murchison and Mr. Richardson both had private islands off the Texas coast. Another oilman, George Strake, had a massive castle up outside Colorado Springs. They just owned – it was just incredible. America had never seen anything like this type of flamboyant wealth, and it spawned, of course, movies like Giant and innumerable Broadway plays and lesser-known movies and novels. And I think, you know, that the smarter ones tried to stay away from a lot of the publicity. Sid Richardson was never one for publicity. He wanted to work much more quietly. But all that publicity, as long as it was positive, of course, man, you know, increased their political visibility and their political power. But it was I call it kind of the golden era of Texas power, kind of in the early to mid 50s, because they just seemed to be everywhere and everything. I mean, I remember the Washington Post ran a 6-part front page series explaining each of these oilmen to the rest of America, that, you know, you know, the power structure in America as we knew it, Rockefellers and DuPonts and mansions on the on Fifth Avenue was really changing, and American power and people really were moving south and west, and it was a big change for America. In fact, the genesis of these, you know, richest American lists, mm-hmm. David, you know, like mm-hmm. the Forbes 400, that all started in the mid-50s as magazines and the media tried to make sense of these changes wrought in America by Texas oilmen.
Yeah. Here, you know, it's kind of hard to imagine, or maybe it's not that hard to imagine, what you would do if you came from modest circumstances and then got to the point where you had enough money so that you literally could have anything
yeah.
you wanted. You know, the old joke about if you have to ask how much, you can't afford it. Well, I guess these guys probably didn't often have to ask how much. Tell me some good stories. Tell us some good stories about some of the things that these men did with their money.
Well, I actually say at some point in the book, these men were the original Beverly Hillbillies. I mean, they each came from exceedingly modest means and became, you know, overnight millionaires, if not billionaires. And a lot of what they did now seems commonplace because we're accustomed to great displays of wealth in the last 20, 30 years. But back then, it was all quite new. Clint Murchison was probably the first man in Texas to have his own swimming pool. You know, that was kind of a big deal. He was also the first of the oilmen to have a private airplane, which was amazing in the 1930s. He built took over a polo club in North Dallas and turned it into his kind of own compound and used to land the planes there in his backyard, in essence. You know, as I mentioned, Mr. Murchison and Mr. Richardson both bought beautiful islands in the Gulf of Mexico just off the Texas coast. In fact, the Richardson Island, which is called St. Joe's, is still in the Bast family as a retreat. You know, they bought ranch after ranch after ranch. Mr. Murchison must have bought several million acres in northern Mexico. I mean, just about anything you can think of that could be bought, they bought. All the requisite mansions that you would expect. There's got to be other things I'm living out, but if you can think of it, they bought it. I mean, up including, you know, championship football teams. At one point in 1966, I think it was, something on the order of 6 out of the 24, you know, NFL teams, football teams, were owned by Texas oilmen.
Hmm. I think you're talking about the Murchison and Richardson, the two guys who had their own islands. I think if I remember that story, one of these guys bought their island first, and then the other guy said, huh, well, this guy's got his own island. I'm going to have my own island, too.
Well, that's exactly what happened. Mr. Murchison bought Matagorda Island, half of it, actually, just off the coast, and he put in a compound, and he and his buddies would go down there and drink bourbon and shoot stuff. And after a while, Mr. Richardson, of course, he and Mr. Murchison had grown up together under humble circumstances in Athens, Texas. And before long, Mr. Richardson just started grumbling, "The dadgummit, I want an island of my own." And so he bought one, the next island over, about 20 miles long, built a beautiful modern home, one of the more distinct homes, in fact, ever built in Texas. Not that any Texans have ever seen it, because nobody ever goes there. It's a private island. And then, of course, later the sons branched out and bought islands elsewhere. Clint Murchison bought Spanish Key and in the Bahamas, and so that type of ostentation was handed down to the second generation, certainly.
Yeah. So that's what, you know, these you could see these guys were members of a very small and very exclusive club. Did they regard in what sense did they regard each other as, you know, fellow members of the club, or was there also a lot of competition between them, competition about how much money they were making and what kind of toys they had?
Yeah, I would have expected that type of competition that you would read about in places like Vanity Fair today. In fact, you don't see it. You didn't see it very much. There seems to be a sense that, dadgummit, there's enough oil for all of us. And also, there's a characteristic of the domestic oil industry in which they always, American oilmen, especially Texas oilmen, seem to believe that they're persecuted by the rest of the country. The rest of the country doesn't like them, doesn't trust them, and so they tend to cling together for support. So Best I can tell, there was not a lot of bad blood among the Big Four. One of the few times you can ever see them in direct competition was when one of Mr. Hunt's sons, Lamar, and Mr. Merkson's son, Clint Jr., both started NFL teams in Dallas in the early 1960s and went head-to-head for season ticket holders and the like. And ultimately, Mr. Merkson won, kept the Cowboys there, and Lamar Hunt ended up moving his Dallas, Texas to Kansas City, where they remain today, the Kansas City Chiefs.
Let's talk with some other callers here. Up next, someone in Urbana, here where we are. This is line one. Hello.
Good morning. This is a fabulous interview. I'd like to move the time reference ahead a couple of decades from where you started to the period covered by the movie Charlie Wilson's War. In the movie, an activist, a very conservative activist, played by Julia Roberts, says she works with a bunch of very conservative wealthy people in Texas. Is that the descendants of the people that you're talking about in your book?
That's Joanne Herring.
Yes.
And while she was certainly big money and probably even big rich by Texas standards, I don't believe she's, in fact, I know she was not associated with any of these Big Four families. But that type of conservative giving spawned in the 1950s has endured to the present day. You can look at it in Charlie Wilson's War. Bunker Hunt, who was one of Mr. Hunt's sons, was a big giver to the Iran-Contras in the 1980s and found himself, I think, grilled by congressional investigators. So, you know, by the 80s, by the 90s, you know, that type of giving just seems so much more common. We accept it. But there I think there will always be large sources of conservative money, such as Mrs. Herring. Boy, wasn't Julia Roberts great in that movie, too? I don't think she got enough credit for that movie. But that type of thing is not terribly unusual in Texas.
When you have, you know, cross-regional contact, like maybe, you know, the Eastern establishment introduces itself to these fellas, there's got to be some incidents here that are noteworthy and maybe even comical.
Well, there were, because that initial generation back in the 40s and 50s didn't think too much of Easterners.
Uh-huh.
They distrusted them because, of course, they wanted to give the blacks more rights and things like that. But the fact is, the smarter oilmen, and that would be most of my Big Four, managed to make their peace with the East in large part because their banks, Chase Manhattan and the like, were in the East. And also, one of the smartest thing that these families did is they started sending their children to school in the East. All the Basses went to school at Yale, the Merksons at Princeton. Only the Hunts, unfortunately, who didn't, of course, do quite so well, didn't go in for the best education. Eventually, that type of East versus West kind of died down, although, of course, it was front and center in what was the largest takeover fight in U.S. history at that time in 1960, when the Merksons went after a big East Coast company called Allegheny. And, of course, all Life magazine, all the magazines played that up as the great fight between the new Texas and the old East. But, you know, that type of thing, Texas modernized quickly. Texas grew up. Texas matured. That didn't become as toxic later as it was early.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. Others are welcome. We have maybe about 10 minutes left in this hour of Focus. Our guest is Brian Burrow. He's a special correspondent at Vanity Fair. He's the author of a number of books. His most recent is The Big Rich, The Rise and Fall of the Greatest Texas Oil Fortunes. Penguin is the publisher. Questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that, these guys made their money by discovering oil. Maybe it was in the early 1930s, and it was the Depression, and it was a time when the major oil companies didn't have a lot of money to spend themselves on exploration. So it was a great time for wildcatters and independents, people who were actually going out and doing the looking, and then when they found it, the oil companies were happy to come along and exploit it. Is there any room for these kind of people today? Are there people like this still in the business today?
Yeah, there are still wildcatters in Texas, but the days of an individual wildcatter finding a big field have passed. In fact, I think they pretty much passed by the 1960s, both because it became the costs of finding oil just shot up so high, and because their fathers and grandfathers had found all the easy pools of oil near the surface, you had to drill deeper and deeper, which was even more expensive. But I think by the 60s, most of the, in fact, all the great pools of oil in Texas had been found, and in fact, some of the best Texas wildcatters began looking overseas. Bunker Hunt found one of the largest oil fields in history in Libya, promptly lost it when he managed to get himself nationalized by irking Muammar Gaddafi. But no, I think that while there are still wildcatters in Texas, they're by and large marginal players looking for small fields, sharing the expenses with others. Some people have asked me, you know, is it possible to go from, you know, being a nobody to a billionaire in America today, like these fellows did? And I've said, well, yeah, if you write software. You know, that's kind of the modern analogy, are these software billionaires of the 90s in the last 15 years. That's kind of the nearest parallel I can think of to what these men did 75 years ago.
Yeah, even though we're talking about different time, different politics, different business, that these guys were, they were like the equivalent of, well, somebody like Bill Gates is today, that's what these guys were in their heyday.
That's exactly right. They were the Bill Gateses and Warren Buffets of their day. If you can imagine Bill Gates in a big 10-gallon hat on a horse, cursing out Easterners and flying out to his private island. That's basically the type of characters that I'm writing about in The Big Rich. And, you know, growing up in Texas, I grew up with these stories, and I was just so happy to kind of put them back together and reintroduce them to a country that I think is kind of forgetting these people. I mean, we know the archetype, we know the stereotype, but the reality of it, I think, is largely fading from view.
Yeah. Got at least one more caller here, someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my talk call.
Mm-hmm.
The analogy with Bill Gates is very interesting. I think, you know, to become a software giant like Microsoft did, you really need skill and vision. And I was wondering to what extent you think finding this oil and becoming these millionaires overnight was kind of like playing the lottery, and to what extent that really involved skill and foresight, or, you know, doing something better than the next guy. And then you talked about how, you know, it impacted the media reporting on the rich and the values in American politics. So I was wondering if you see also changes in the way businesses are conducted and businesses are done and businesses see themselves.
Well, that's such a great question, because it's dead on accurate. When these fellows rose to political prominence during the 1950s, their critics, the first thing the critics would say was that, oh, you don't have to listen to these guys, they just got lucky. In fact, I think Wendell Willkie in 1940 was one of the first people to say this publicly, when he got into a kind of a tete-a-tete with Roy Cullen during the 1940 presidential candidates. And Mr. Willkie's comment was something to the extent of, you know, good Lord puts all this oil in the ground, and then some fella comes along who's never been in excess at anything, finds it, sells it, and suddenly he's an expert on everything from handguns to hand grenades, something like that. So the question is, you know, is that realistic? Is that fair criticism? I think really only a bit of it is. Yes, there will always be a certain amount of luck in finding oil, but the fact is nobody who is kind of a gentleman oil finder ever finds much oil. You've got to be tenacious and you know, just stay after it and after it and after it and after it until, you know, in other words, the oilman who manages to drill 200 oil wells is going to be a lot luckier than the one who drills two. I think there's a little bit of luck to it, but by and large, its skill. And then within oil itself, you can even point to certain things that my Big Four did that no one had ever done before. And the best example of that is this fellow Roy Cullen down in Houston made his fortune by coming up with the now very obvious idea, but when he did it in 1920, he was the first that, you know, all this oil had been found, you know, up near the surface of the land within about 3,000 feet below where you stand. And he just decided, well, I know it's going to be a little bit more expensive, but how about we start going down deeper? And he actually devised some technical ways of drilling through geologic formations that others had been unable to drill through. And by doing so, not only made himself a very, very rich man, but opened all of Texas to even deeper drilling.
Does that get at your question?
Yes, thank you very much. And do you see virtues in business behavior and business conducting that changed with the times? Or
Certainly. I mean, look, business will always, any given business, which is just a collection of human beings, will always conduct its business the way it wants to by its own rules until someone, whether it's the government or the media, shines a light on it. And I think as government and certainly the media has gotten so much more pervasive and written so much more about business over the last 30, 35 years, that's, I think, you know, made American corporations act in to use behaviors that I think are more responsible than perhaps their predecessors or ancestors might do. I mean, good grief, we're sitting here on TV watching, BP give us commercials not about oil and gas, but, you know, how they're going to go after alternative fuels because that's what the public demands. So, yeah, I would never say that it's businesses have changed the way they act in a kind of 180 degrees from what they used to. But I think they're, by and large, tend to be better corporate citizens than they might have been, say, 30, 40 years ago.
Well, I appreciate the comments of the caller. We just have about a minute or so left. At the beginning, we talked about how you were now in the enviable position as a writer that essentially you could pick projects that excited you and write about those things, and that really that's why you did Public Enemies and Big Rich. So what are you working on now?
Good question. I've still got a day job at Vanity Fair, and I've been off – talking about these books for a while. I've lately been having to go back to tend to my knitting. I don't know what I'm going to do next, David. And you know, after about a month from now, when all this dies down, I'm going to start getting worried because I don't know what it's going to be. I don't have the obvious thing. I'm much too picky. You know, I want like the perfect thing that excites me because, you know, if you're going to go, you know, lock yourself up in a room, figuratively, you know, for 5 years with one subject, it's got to be a subject that really excites you because, but believe me, I've seen the alternative, and for me it was not pretty, where you get a couple of years into a book and suddenly decide this is just not what I wanted it to be. So I take a long time before I make a decision, probably too long.
All right.
But maybe here by the end of the year I'll be on something new.
All right. Well, if folks want to read the story, it's a good story about the rise and fall of the greatest Texas oil fortunes. You look for this new book. It's The Big Rich. It's published by Penguin Press. You also might be interested in his previous book, Public Enemies, America's Greatest Crime Wave and the Birth of the FBI. That's now out in paper, published by Penguin, and will be a motion picture coming out this summer. Our guest, Brian Burrow, he is a special correspondent at Vanity Fair. And Mr. Burrow, thanks very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
WILO programs made possible by the Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta now open in their new location at Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information at 359-7377. This is WILO Radio. We're a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. We'll break at this point for an update on the markets and news. We'll be back, so please stay tuned.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where we're seeing a softer tone to the marketplace today as traders await results from NASS this afternoon on planting progress for corn and soybeans, and tomorrow morning's reports out of the WASD as we keep an eye out for ending stocks both in the U.S. as well as the first look for world-ending stocks and production numbers for the 2009-2010 growing season. Let's look at the particulars in Kansas City. May wheat now at 629 and three quarters, up 2 3/4. July 632 and a half, down a half. At the Chicago Board of Trade, May wheat at 580, down a half. July 588 and a quarter, down 2 3/4. May corn 411, down 3. July 418 and 3/4, down 2 1/4. December 438, down 1.